Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where John Nethercoat makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. John was educated at the University of Sydney, at the Australian National University and at the London School of Economics. He spent 17 years with the Public Service Board in Canberra and another 12 years with the Department of the Senate in Parliament House. He worked on the Royal Commission into Australian Government Administration under Nugget Coombs and the Public Service Commission in Canada. John has edited 36 books. He was editor for a couple of decades of the influential Canberra Bulletin of Public Administration. He writes occasionally for the Canberra Times, and he's currently an adjunct professor at the Australian Catholic University on the ANU campus. And John Nethercoat's going to speak for us tonight on Canberra Nights, the Rise and Fall of the Public Service Mandarins. John, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Jared. It's a pleasure to be here this evening. I've been a member of the Sydney Institute for quite a number of years, sometimes unhappily unfinancial. I'm pleased to be here in general. I'm particularly pleased because a couple of friends from school have shown up and, as they say, made themselves known to me. So I've at least had one pleasure this evening. My topic tonight, I was asked what I was... I told a friend of mine I was going to be speaking to the Sydney Institute, and she said, well, what's the topic? I said, Canberra Nights. And she said, oh, you're going to give the backstory on Ashley Madison, are you? I said, Nights with a K, Nights with a K. We're talking about an important era in the history of Australian government and the history of Australian public service. It's the era of the Mandarins. It's also the era of the graduates. It follows the era of the clerks and the veterans of the First World War, who dominated the public service from its foundation to about 1940. And in more recent decades, the place has been taken over by people who like to think of themselves as managers, also ministerial staff, and above all, the computer. Tonight's story is about the age of the files. Let me bracket it with two stories. At the beginning of this era, the era, from my point of view, dates from about 1937 when Roland Wilson, Dr. Roland Wilson, PhD, Phil Oxford, PhD, Chicago, was appointed Australian statistician. His appointment occasioned a strike, or as we used to say, a stoppage, partly because he was young, partly because people didn't feel he had required seniority, but worst of all, he was a university graduate. And for many years, including in my own time in the public service, university graduates were regarded by many people as a very low order of life who got on with special privileges to which they had no real entitlement. The era broadly ends about 1987. You could date it from 1979 when Sir Frederick Wheeler and Sir Arthur Tang retired. You could date it from 1984 when John Stone, although he doesn't consider himself a Mandarin, in some ways he's one of the greatest of them all, he retired in 1984. You could date it from 1986 when Sir Geoffrey Yean left the Department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet. You might even date it from 1987 when the very last of the Knights retired. Sir William Cole retired as head of the Department of Defence. Cole had another distinction. He was one of the few people to start his public service career, a few people of his generation to start his career as what was called a junior postal officer. And in the old era, to go from junior postal officer to chief clerk was a mark of enormous success in life. And Cole, as I say, started out as a JPO and ended up as a chief clerk. Well, my two stories, one dates from 1948, middle of August, shortly after the High Court of Australia had brought in its decision on the Melbourne Corporation case. This was the Melbourne Corporation had challenged the legislation of the Chifley government to require state government authorities and instrumentalities to bank with the Commonwealth Bank of Australia, which was then both a trading bank and also a government-owned trading bank, and also the central bank before the creation of the Reserve Bank in 1959. On the Friday afternoon, there was a meeting in the office of the Prime Minister and Treasurer, Ben Chifley. And in the course of the Cabinet had been meeting for most of the day, in the course of this gathering, the people present were Dr. Roland Wilson, Professor Kenneth Bailey, the Solicitor General, Dr. H.C. Coombs, Nugget Coombs, and Mr. F.H. Wheeler, the ranking officer of the Treasury. These people were among the most influential officials in the land, and there was a little pause in the discussion with the Prime Minister, and one of them said, PM, what are you going to do about the Melbourne Corporation case? And Chifley said, I'm going to nationalise the banks. Now, these four men, all of whom I met, and some of them I knew quite well, these were not shrinking violets. But the facts are that on this occasion they were struck dumb. Nobody said anything. And one of them, Wheeler, said it was a day of great shame for him. Why was it a shame? Well, because Wheeler, who was the great advocate of due process and frank and fearless advice, took the view that the official should have protested at what the Prime Minister had said and asked that the High Court judgment should be subjected to intensive examination to see whether it would hold up, to see whether the government's purposes could be accomplished by other methods, to see what all the options were. Anyway, the Prime Minister had made up his mind. The following day, the Cabinet met throughout the Saturday, and late in the afternoon, Don Rogers, the Prime Minister's press secretary, issued a 45-word statement announcing the government's intention to nationalise the private banks. 45 words. You can see this is the era before spin. Well, that's one story. If we go forward 27 years to December 1974, in the same neighbourhood, Parliament House, we have another meeting. It's a bigger meeting. It has some of the same cast of characters were there. By this time, Chiff, of course, had died, as had Sir Kenneth Bailey. But Sir Roland Wilson was chairman of the Commonwealth Bank. Sir Frederick Wheeler was the head of the Treasury. And Dr. Coombs was safely on the other side of the lake, where he was presiding over the inquiry into the public service, and where I used to work for a time. At this meeting, there were quite a number of people present, as I say, perhaps 20 or 25. There were several ministers. You remember Rex Connor, the Strangler? He was there. Lionel Murphy was there. He was the Attorney General. And indeed, he was, for a time, the star of the meeting. They were discussing Mr. Connor's desire to raise $4 billion US for, as he put it, energy purposes. But the question was, the practice in those days was that for a loan of that magnitude, you needed to get Loan Council approval. Loan Council was a gathering of the treasurers of the the Commonwealth and of all the states of the Commonwealth. And but there was a let-out clause in the financial agreement. The let-out clause was that money could be raised without approval of the Loan Council if it was for temporary purposes. Now, Mr. Connor's loan was for 20 years. But Lionel Murphy, on the cusp of appointment as a judge of the High Court of Australia, he explained that there was no need to get Loan Council approval because it was a loan for temporary purposes. The Prime Minister at the time, Mr. Whitlam, arrived, and he was, of course, dumbstruck at this suggestion that a loan for 20 years was merely for temporary purposes, and started to question particularly Murphy, but also Connor. A little later, Sir Frederick Wheeler arrived and moved into exactly the same line of questioning, along the way telling the assembled company that informed public opinion simply wouldn't accept the idea that a loan for temporary purposes would run for 20 years. Whitlam became agitated at Wheeler's interventions. Now, I had many dealings with Wheeler over the years, and for those of you who know university practice, it was a conversation with Sir Frederick was a sort of perpetual viva voce. And on this occasion, Wheeler was posing any number of questions, and Whitlam just became very impatient with him and said, "Oh, come off it, Fred. You're on the skids." Now, for those of you who get your history from Jenny Hocking, you know, the Whitlam biographer, and regarded by Mr. Whitlam as Australia's premier political biographer, if you get your history from Jenny Hocking, that's where the story ends. But I've checked this with numerous people, and there is a denouement. Wheeler was never one to take a put-down lightly. And Wheeler simply responded, "Prime Minister, I wish to inform you of facts, your ignorance of which will bring you down." So you can see that we've come a long way from the time when prime ministers make announcements and public servants, even senior and eminent public servants, sit there and do nothing, to a time when ministers are really brought up to the barrier. Well, Wheeler was one of the great figures of the Mandarin age, Chairman of the Public Service Board from 1960 to 71, Secretary of the Treasury from 71 to 79. There were other great figures. We've mentioned Sir Rowland Wilson, Secretary of Labor from 40 to 46, statistician, economic advisor to the Treasurer, Secretary to the Treasury for 15 years. You probably all know about Rowland. He used to sign the banknotes. Sir Kenneth Bailey, Solicitor General and Secretary of the Attorney General's Department for close on 20 years, then Australian High Commissioner in Canada, later on Special Advisor on International Law to the Department of Foreign Affairs. Among others, Sir Arthur Tang, Head of External Affairs for 11 years, Secretary of Defence for 9 years, the architect of the modern arrangements for defence administration in Australia. These were all the new graduates, the graduates who came in at the start of the war. They all came, they were specially recruited. They worked either for heads of department or other very senior figures in departments. They often worked for ministers. In the ordinary sense, they never had any experience of normal hierarchies. They obviously had some experience of hierarchy, but they never had the ordinary experience of working your way up over 10 or 15 years before you might reach some position of real responsibility. They were fortunate people in that if they got to university, they went to small classes. For example, there was an elite group in the late 1930s at the University of Melbourne. Wheeler was, this is the honours group in economics and commerce. Fred Wheeler, Sir Bruce Williams, later Vice Chancellor of the University of Sydney, Sir Lennox Hewitt. I'm just looking around to see if Sir Lennox is here. As Gerard knows, I have a bit of worry about Sir Lennox. Sir Lennox is now 97 years of age.
I saw him an hour ago and said good evening, but not here.
Thank you, Anthony. Sir Lennox Hewitt. These people came up to Canberra at the outbreak of war with Sir Douglas Copeland, who had been appointed to as Price's commissioner. Wheeler, very shortly afterwards, went to work directly for the then head of the Treasury, Stuart Macfarlane, or as he was often known as Misery Mac. It's important when we think about this era that we remember that there was an old guard, and the old guard was itself a cadre of extremely capable officials. Most of them, or in fact practically none of them except the lawyers, they didn't go to university. They quite often took accountancy qualifications through the whatever the Society of Accountants was called in those days. Important figures in this group is Sir Frederick Shedden, the most influential figure in the conduct of the war. You often see photographs of John Curtin, and Fred Shedden will be at his elbow. Another one was Sir William Dunk, who became chairman of the Public Service Board in 1947, a very major figure. He presided over the early years of the computerisation of the public service. The public service, the Commonwealth Public Service, was one of the earliest institutions in Australia to adopt automatic data processing, as it was called in those days. That was the work of Sir William Dunk. He was also behind bringing the public service from Melbourne to Canberra. Not everybody regards that as a progressive step, but nonetheless, it's part of his curriculum vitae. Dunk was also alert to many of the deficiencies in both the public service and, more to the point, the legislation governing the public service. But when it came to rectifying these deficiencies, the best that Sir William could do was to suggest to the Prime Minister that they brought Sir Frederick Wheeler back from Geneva, where he was treasurer of the International Labour Organisation. So these were big figures, but they didn't have the lustre of the Mandarinate. Another important figure, very important figure, was Alf Rattigan, who had joined the public service in the late 20s, and he, of course, shouldered the burden of the fight against John McEwen over the tariff in the 1960s, and he was another one of the people who you would think of as being in the old guard. Another point to make about the service at this time is that it was the era of sectarianism. Catholics and Masons squared off against each other. It's very difficult to get at the heart of the sectarian question. I've read over the years a number of books, people recording their memoirs of their time in the public service, and I say to them over a coffee, "Now, you must have encountered a bit of sectarianism in the course of your long career, Bob." "Oh, yes, it was everywhere." "I think you should put it into the book, you know. I mean, people were interested in this kind of subject, but it never appears." And earlier this year, I reviewed a book called The Career Service. It came out 50 years ago. I wrote an article about it to mark its 50th anniversary. A very, very good book of a quality that academics these days don't write. And I said, you know, the big gap in the book is that it doesn't mention Masons and Catholics. And, it turned out, I said this was an oversight, but somebody or other sent the review to the author, who now lives in Los Angeles, and lo and behold, back came an email from him to tell me it wasn't an oversight, but there was a lot of bitterness between Catholics and Masons in the public service in the 50s and 60s, and he just felt it safer to write his book and not mention it. Well, it goes without saying that that many of these people, that there's a big history of anecdotes about them. And, of course, one of the great promoters of anecdotage was Menzies, who he and Chifley were really the patrons of this elite cadre. And on one occasion, Sir Alan Watt, head of the Department of External Affairs in the early 50s, showed up at an airport wearing a raincoat and carrying an umbrella. Menzies immediately swooped upon him and said, "Tell me, Watt, do you wear braces as well as a belt?" And Sir Alan, who was a rather stiff individual, of course, didn't think this was at all funny. And he politely answered the Prime Minister without evincing the slightest smile. Roland Wilson one day was travelling with Menzies and the plane landed in Iceland for a fuel stop. And as it was taxiing along the runway, Menzies looks out and sees a very barren, uninspiring, totally depressing landscape. And he says, Wilson, have a look out this window. Now, what does that remind you of? And Wilson looks out at this barren, depressing, featureless landscape, and he can't think. Brilliant as he was, he couldn't think of any reason whatsoever why the Prime Minister would want to bring this landscape to his attention. Menzies enlightened him. Menzies told him it reminded him of a typical report from the Treasury. Well, again, Roland didn't think this was very funny at all. And Menzies was although he always drew clear distinctions between work and play and dining and drinking and so forth, when he travelled, he liked good company out of hours. And Roland didn't really measure up in this department. And so what would happen when Menzies was going abroad was that he would... he wouldn't say anything until about a day or two before departure, and then he would say, "Roland, look, I know you'll be too busy to come with me. I wondered if you could spare Dick." Dick was Sir Richard Randall. He was a Deputy Secretary in the Treasury for many years. He knocked back various honours that were directed at him, so eventually Menzies just simply recommended him for a knighthood. Randall was always dressed as if he bought his clothes from St Vincent de Paul or the Opportunity shop. He rolled his own, which frequently just hung out of the left-hand side of his mouth. He used, remember the old pen and nibs, you know, he had an inkwell on his desk. And one day Randall walked down the passageway outside the ministerial suites, between the ministerial suites and the chamber of the House of Representatives, walked down it with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth, and Fadden, the treasurer of the time, had a group of people standing around him, and silence fell as the Deputy Secretary of the Treasury passed by, and Fadden's comment was, "Flash bugger, Dick." Wheeler was heavily into, if you sent memos to him, he'd quite often read the memo and he'd annotate them plusspk, P-L-S-S-P-K. Eventually, one of the officers of the Public Service Board, in fact you might remember him, Richard Farmer, he used to run a drink business, he was also an advisor to the News Corporation on betting odds. One day, Richard at one stage bought a bulldog, and it came into the office and people gathered around to admire it, and somebody said, "What are you going to call it, Dick?" And Richard said, "Oh, so ugly, I've just got to call it Fred." And there was a bit of trouble as Frederick was just walking down the corridor at this particular moment. Anyway, Richard had no fewer than 175 crucifixes in his folder. So he sent a memo to Wheeler to say, well, I've got these 175 crucifixes, what do you think we should do about it? And back came Wheeler's reply. Anybody want to guess what the reply said? Crucifix. So he now had 176. There was a famous occasion, as I said, a conversation with Sir Frederick was like a perpetual viva voce, and one of the people who became very impatient with this was Paul Hasluck when he was in the Department of External Affairs. And in those days they worked in West Block. You probably all know West Block. It's just behind Old Parliament House on the left hand side. And the doors had glass, you know, there was a wooden frame and then there was glass. And well, Hasluck got fed up with trying to do some business with Fred on this occasion, walked out of the room, slammed the door shut and shattered the glass. The important thing to know about the mandarins of the era is that they weren't all house trained, so that a period when I was working for Sir Arthur Tang, I'd be sitting at my desk, the phone would ring, "Tang here, can you come around?" So, and then after our meetings were finished, he'd often say, "Oh, time to go, just get up, put his overcoat on." And I used to wait till I saw him in the car park before I felt it safe to leave, lest I'd be accused of dereliction of duty. Well, we can tell lots of stories about these guys, but it was a very important era. The Knights of Canberra. Now, Canberra wasn't exactly Camelot, but there were similarities between the Knights of Canberra and the Knights of the Round Table. These men, they were all men, they saw public service as a profession and as a vocation, and they spent quite a lot of time formulating ideals of service, and they included things like impartiality, frank and fearless advice, due process. They were very firm about everything that was done had to be based on law, and this was an important contribution to laying secure foundations for the conduct of Commonwealth business. They also were very active in policy debate. And they were by no means unanimous amongst themselves. There were some who were very keen on growth and development, and they, on the whole, tended to the view that governments shouldn't do too much, and if they were going to do anything, it should be a very clear reason why government intervention was needed and why government expenditure was needed. There were others who were, Coombs of whom is probably the most famous, who were very much concerned with distribution and equality. There was an intervening group who were very anxious to promote growth, but they saw the instruments of growth in the form of public intervention in various forms. These people mainly congregated in the Department of Trade, the McEwen. They were really part of the McEwenite Empire. And the leading figure in that particular group, that particular strand of thinking, was Sir John Crawford, who later became Vice-Chancellor, then Chancellor of the Australian National University. There was a huge amount of debate that went on in government circles in this era, which essentially centred around these subjects, these themes. Roland Wilson, the head of the Treasury, he saw it as a major part of his responsibility was to keep an eye on what Crawford was up to. There was also a lot of rivalry amongst them. Arthur Tang, for example, as it were, hierarchically stalked Crawford, and it was a great relief to Arthur in 1960 when he finally accomplished two goals. One is that he got his salary onto the same level as Crawford's, and they both got their knighthoods on the same day. This was an enormous achievement. The big disputes came in. The biggest disputes came in the 1960s with the attack on the tariff. McEwen won the first round. Sir Leslie Melville had been appointed chairman of the tariff board. He was the one who started to raise questions about what value the country and the economy were getting out of the protective tariff, which had been, of course, one of the very great pillars of the Federation. Melville was forced out of the chairmanship of the tariff board and replaced, as I say, by Alf Rattigan, who was a much less spectacular figure, but in the end he was the one who effectively defeated the McEwen defence. It still took another 20 or 25 years to get on top of the tariff, but nonetheless that was a big issue. The Vernon Report on the economy, tabled in Parliament in about just 50 years ago, we were coming up to the 50th anniversary of the Vernon Committee report. It was a report that was very keen on indicative planning. In fact, Crawford and his team were all fond of, they admired the work of the Commissariat du Plan in France and the Ministry for International Trade and Industry in Japan, and they sort of had ambitions of emulating these institutions in Australia, and this was a major recommendation of the Vernon Committee report on the economy. Wilson got to Menzies, and Menzies totally crushed the report in one of his last speeches in the House of Representatives. Now, I just finished by saying that the age of the mandarins came to an end for a variety of reasons. Let me just mention some of them. Of course, the fact that they all got together while the nation was at war was extremely important in building, developing cohesion and common purpose amongst them. As time went on, of course, hierarchies grew, and even if somebody, say, like John Steyn had a fairly rapid rise up the hierarchy, it was still a longer haul than his great mentor, Roland Wilson, had to work. After Menzies retired, subsequent prime ministers were much less deferential to the senior officials, as the story about Whitlam and Wheeler reveals. Tenure was weakened. When John Gordon became prime minister, he removed the venerable Sir John Bunting as head of the Prime Minister's Department and brought in Sir Lennox Hewitt, or Hewitt became Sir under Gordon's Prime Ministership. The mandarins thrived on the exclusivity of information, but of course with photocopying and later the internet, it was much less difficult to control information and to keep it by yourself. There was the rise of ministerial staff, or as Shakespeare insightfully described them in Richard II, the caterpillars of the Commonwealth. So I like to say the first known reference to Australian government in literature. New Parliament House, which is a bit of a ghetto in Canberra, I just pass that on to you for, and then there's the ghetto within the ghetto, that is to say the ministerial wing, but it's dominated by ministerial staff, and the regular officials don't find it very easy to penetrate. The older officials spent a whole career in the same field of administration, or many of them did. That's no longer the case. We're all very keen on mobility in Canberra these days, and have been for 30 years. 30 years, and there's the general decline of the eminence of the public service. Once upon a time, the head of the Treasury and the governor of the Reserve Bank were peers in every respect. Well, this is no longer the case. The governor of the Reserve Bank gets twice as much as the head of the Treasury. The head of the Treasury can be given the flick at any moment, as indeed happened when the Abbott government was elected and removed Dr. Martin Parkinson. The governor of the bank has a 7-year tenure. The Solicitor General is vastly more important now than the Secretary of the Attorney General's Department. The two jobs have been broken where Kenneth Bailey had both of them. And these days, and this, you know, really does show you where the public service is in the pecking order, the head of the Prime Minister's Department is now far and away the best remunerated public servant, well ahead of the head of the Treasury. And as I like to say, and on this matter I can assure you that John Stone in particular agreed with me, that if you were filling the headship of Prime Minister's Department, well, the long list is pretty long, and even the short list is pretty long. If you're filling the head of the Treasury, the long list is pretty short, and the short list really has more than a couple of names. But nonetheless, if the money's what you're interested in, then you must go for the Prime Minister's Department. Well, on that note, I have got a paper underway here, as you can see, and you'll be able to read it on the Institute's website in about a week or so. And I'll give you some very interesting quotes from, including John Stone's famous blindingly obvious minute. But I'm now very happy to take all sorts of questions from you.
Many thanks, John. And so we come to question and discussion. If you're in line of the camera, don't stand in front of the camera. We look forward to your paper in the Sydney Papers online. When I commenced in Canberra with the Fraser government in 1976, there was a view around that in the early years of the Fraser government, I wasn't working for Fraser, I was working for a junior minister, but there was a view around in the early years of the Fraser government that Malcolm Fraser wanted to restore the public service to what it had been under Menzies and to overturn the influence of Gough Whitlam and the stress on private staff under Whitlam. And I recall that at that stage, Frederick Wheeler was very highly regarded as Secretary of the Treasury. People were saying he was going to write the 76 budget. He probably did. But it didn't seem to last with Fraser. So what happened that changed Fraser's intention from what seemed to be to restore the significance of the Mandarins to, by the end of his 7-year term, that seems to have been fading away?
Well, what Gerard's recollection is absolutely correct, that Malcolm Fraser came back in on a policy of restoring the great traditions of the public service. But he was fairly selective. The first thing that he didn't do was to... He fired all the ministerial staff who had jobs under the Whitlam government, but he replaced them with his own people so that the ministerial staff innovation of the Whitlam years carried over into the Fraser period. Now, there are many good arguments for ministers having a little staff of their own, and the case is set out in the Sir Humphrey chapter of John Howard's book on the Menzies era. But as far as restoring the traditions of the public service, this was a factor. Fraser also liked, although again, he believed in the tenure of heads of department, right up to the point when he wanted to get rid of them. So he brought in legislation which made it very... That was the first weakening of the tenure of the public service. And Malcolm also wasn't very fond of frank and fearless advice unless it agreed with him. So that was another bit of a hold-up. when in the end of 1976 he decided to divide the Treasury and create a Treasury which was an economics ministry, the one that we have today, and also to create a budget agency, the Department of Finance, these two functions that for 75 years resided in the same institution. Fraser actually said while discussions on this move were underway that he didn't care what other people thought, and he particularly didn't care what Fred Wheeler and John Steyn thought. So I think we have to say that whatever Malcolm's commitment was, it was not an informed commitment.
Lindsay.
A comment and a question. I recall at the time one of the justifications for calling the $4 billion loan temporary was that Parliament House had been called temporary for 50 years by then, and 4 years was nothing.
Provisional.
The question is, assuming there's some degree of truth in yes, Minister and yes, Prime Minister, how much of the future of the country was decided on tennis courts and in the Commonwealth Club in Canberra?
Well, a lot of it wasn't decided at the Commonwealth Club because it was only created in the late 1950s. So, you know, but these were stories that used to go round about how things were settled at the over drinks or places like that. But, well, who can say? When Menzies was the Prime Minister, of course, Menzies studied the paperwork pretty thoroughly, but he didn't always allow himself to be rushed. But I don't think there was any. Menzies was very Rooseveltian with the top of the public service. He always was playing Wilson and Coombs off against each other in particular. And he also had other people keeping a close eye on what was going on over in the trade department. So that, you know, as I say, Menzies really, in his era, used them as a check on each other. And he, you know, he was very clever the way he used to deal with them, and he'd take them down to his favourite club, the West Brighton Club, or sometimes if they were especially favoured, he'd take them to the Savage Club on Saturday nights. But I think it's the best way to regard the Mandarins is, in fact, as part of the Prime Minister's Court in the Chifley and Menzies period, which after all was a 20-year period. And both Chif and much more so Menzies was very skillful at interrogating official advice, particularly if he had some apprehensions about it. So I enjoy all those stories, but I think they're overdone, or I could put it another way. I used to think during the Hawke government that, by which time the secretaries, of course, had all taken to playing tennis or were going for jogging in the lunch hour, I thought that it would do quite a number of them a lot of good to have a little sit down and a little talk. In fact, Fred Wheeler said to me one day, what does Walensky do in his lunch hour? And I said, well, if he doesn't have a tennis match on, he goes for a jog. However does he do the work?
There's a question here.
John, could you reflect for us, reflect upon the decline of the frank and fearless Mandarins in favour these days of the rise of the chiefs of staff in terms of...
The chiefs of staff.
The chiefs of staff of... Prime Ministers, in terms of the effect on government.
It's a question about the decline of the frank and fearless advice and the replacement by advice from Chiefs of Staff.
Well, Vicky, the first thing I'd say is we can overdo the frank and fearless advice. I think a lot of... Coombs, for example, if he disagreed with a minister, usually would wait till you had to ask Coombs what he thought. He wasn't going to volunteer a a contrary view, despite what he put into his book Trial Balance. The chiefs of staff. Well, this is a difficult one, Vicky. I mentioned the mobility. Now, I'm almost, but I don't see the documentation. But I'm almost prepared to accept the view of a lot of people these days that official advice is of an indifferent quality these days, and the reason is this business, the fact that they're moving on the move all the time, and so that people's knowledge of the context is, and of course the file, there are no files, you know, so you have to know where to look in the computer system. But the big reason that Frank and Fearless advice went into decline is that tenure was loosened, and so once it was relatively easy to either fire or transfer somebody who was giving you advice that you found unpalatable. Now, if Sir Lennox Stewart was here, he'd tell you, you know, people have got their mortgages to worry about. We can't expect people, children to educate. We can't expect people to put that at risk. And also the subject matters that came up. A number of department heads have said to me the great problem with Frank and Fearless advice is that although you may even have a sequence of decisions which are a bit wobbly, none of them is important, and none of them singly is important enough to make an issue of it. Chiefs of staff, some of them are excellent, and of course some of them are players.
So how important were the knighthoods? I recall that, was it Kingsland, Richard Kingsland, was it, head of repatriation? Mm-hmm. I remember the day he got his knighthood, and he was ecstatic, and he told us how he had woken up and got out the shower and heard about it, and wrapped the towel around him as he took congratulatory calls, he told me. So, I mean, there was a big issue for him. Was that the same for all of them, their knighthoods? Or?
I think for most of them, Gerard, this was an era where basically there weren't too many indicators that you were doing a good job, and the knighthood was pretty significant, and there were various people around who could read the system. So if somebody had been in... If you had, for example, a head of the Treasury who had been there for 8 years and didn't have a knighthood, well, you'd know that there was a little bit of unhappiness around. So that it was very much... It was a reward, as knighthood's honours had long been one of the benefits of service to the Crown. So that was important. And there was also the indicator to all your friends. And it helped after you'd retired, because those with knighthoods found it easier to get invitations to join boards than those who didn't.
And just because we'll go here in a minute, but the knighthoods in those days were just decided by the Prime Minister and Cabinet, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, just the Prime Minister, not the Cabinet.
Just the Prime Minister. So was it an award? Come back here. It was an award to the Prime Minister. Right. There's a question here and then here. Yep.
I thought Mandarins in China got there by passing a rigorous examination. Can you tell us something about recruitment?
Yes. This is where the term comes from. The bureaucrats of the Chinese Empire came in under a rigorous examination system, and the reason that the term is used in the Westminster world is that the recruitment after the Northcote Trevelyan report the Northcote Trevelyan report, I underline it, not the Nethercote Trevelyan report, they came in doing Latin and Greek. And Lord Macaulay, who did a comparable report on the Indian civil service, said, well, the reason we set Latin and Greek is because that's what people study, and that's where you'll find out who the best are, where the best are. But if the subject was Cherokee, well, we'd set the exams in Cherokee. And that's actually in the Macaulay report. But most of the people we've been talking about tonight came in on special recruitment arrangements, personal arrangements. That's why there was the uproar over Wilson's appointment as statistician. But Wheeler and Len Heward came up to Canberra that immediately war was declared because Copeland had been appointed the prices commissioner, and part of his deal was that that Heward and Wheeler and indeed Bruce Williams would come with him. But for health reasons, Williams didn't go to Canberra. Oh, I should mention in that Melbourne University group, and one of their number was Sir John Bunting. And it just amazes people to know that Sir John actually had a degree in economics. And Bunting himself told me I was the duffer in the group. And some years later, I said to Bruce Williams, Jack tells me he was the duffer in the group, and Bruce said, yes, he certainly was.
John, Becky.
Was John Menadue considered a traditional Mandarin, as he had been a political staff?
No. Menadue represents an important break. He'd had a year or two in the public service. Then he'd gone to work for Whitlam when Whitlam became deputy leader of the opposition. Menadue contested the seat of Hume at the 1966 federal elections and then went off to work for Rupert Murdoch, and he was brought back in 1974. Menadue was seen like the ministerial staff as a clear break with the traditional patterns of the public service, and that lay behind the Fraser government legislation regulating the appointment of heads of department.
John, in just a little over 50 years, public service has grown hugely into an institution of its own, educated elites, whatever. But it's very sort of secretive to the ordinary Australian, whatever. The civil service in Britain, I suppose, among those that take an interest in politics, is pretty well noted for its what we'd call captains of industry out in the private world. Is there a case for saying that some of these heads of departments should be more publicly exposed? I mean, they earn heaps of money. They're supposed to give... Well, then we had Max the Axe coming in with John Howard. He just sort of floated in from the outside. It seems only when they become a bit of a cartoon or a stereotype do we ever get to hear of them. But shouldn't there be... We know about the Governor of the Reserve Bank and all of that, but, you know, we don't know much about these captains of the public service.
Max had been a deputy secretary in the Department of Primary Industry. Well, is there a case for knowing more about them? Well, journalists at any time can write profiles on them if they want to. I mean, the main reason that you don't get... See, I'm trying to think, but I told you a few of the anecdotes about the old guard, but the new guard don't have anecdotes, you know. I mean, they've got a number of failings, and one of them is that they don't provide good material for for speeches like this. Also, they're rather bland in the sense that the whole idea, perhaps the head of the Department of Foreign Affairs, maybe the head of Defence, and certainly the head of the Treasury, they actually know something about the field in which they work. But a lot of the others, they're managers. They're managers, you know, and they regard my sort of attitude that, you know, it's not a bad idea if the head of social services knows a little bit of, well, for example, knows what the beverage report is. They just regard that as, well, what would you expect a university chappy to say? In the British Civil Service, by the way, the generic word for an officer is chap. And chappiness is a very important, you know, how did so-and-so get on in their career? Oh, he was a top chap. But we don't have a comparable phrase in Australia.
Lindsay.
As a result of the Senate Estimates Committee system, we now see bureaucrats of all levels on television. I'm not sure that they were trained for that. Is that a good thing or a productive thing? Or?
Well, given the reason that it's not a good thing is that if you follow the estimates proceedings, I call it a trivial pursuit, you know. I mean most of the you know, something like a big expenditure on, well, just to pluck an item out of the air, a submarine, compared to the wine cellar at Kirribilli House. Well, you know, senators have no trouble at all. Sorry, Senator, I know this didn't happen when you were in investments. But, you know, I mean, there are senators, you know, Senator Dastyari, Senator Faulkner, they can keep batting like Bradman on the subject of the wine cellar at Kirribilli House. But, you know, submarines, well, you know, that's a bit technical for me.
Okay, we're getting close to the end now. Have I missed anyone? Just tell us a bit finally about, you mentioned early on the move from the national capital being in Melbourne until 1927, and the move comes, I think, mainly after the Second War. But some of the people you're talking about, the Mandarins, they moved to Canberra in 1940, which I suppose if you go back to the first lot of public servants there, you mentioned many of them are war veterans. What happens to the second lot of these senior figures is that because they're in the public service, they avoid being called up in the Second War. So tell
us... Well, they're in an exempt occupation.
Well, yeah, they're... Well, they're an exempt occupation.
But Randall insisted on going, and he was a private during the war.
Yeah. So tell us about the move from... I mean, it really comes to fruition, what, in the 50s and 60s?
Yes.
And the social consequences, too, because it must have been, in those days, when people had a family in Melbourne, moving to Canberra would have been very difficult.
This is right, and there's quite an interesting story about that. But when they came up in 1927, it was mainly the central departments. Sir Robert Garran, for example, who'd lived for 30 years in Melbourne, he actually moved to Canberra and lived the rest of his life, and he didn't die till 1957. Sir Robert Garran came to Canberra. The Public Service Board came to Canberra. Naturally, Prime Ministers did. I think the Auditor General did, the Treasury. External Affairs didn't exist in that era. But Defence, the Transport Departments, the Welfare Departments, they all stayed in Melbourne. And the war gave Canberra a bit of a push along, but even then the whole running of the war was very difficult between Canberra and Melbourne, and very taxing for Curtin in particular. Fred Shedden moved backwards and forth between Canberra and Melbourne, but it was in the late 50s that Menzies finally decided to get Canberra going. Again, Dame Patty and Heather Henderson were very influential in this. You know, Menzies, you could take the view that Menzies decided to resume what was called the Canberra program so that he could have dinner in peace and quiet at home. But Sir William Dunk was very influential because he took the view that while ever the public service was dispersed around Melbourne, it would never be efficient. And the only way you could make it efficient was to centralise it and bring it to Canberra. And the other part of my answer to that is that in about 3 months' time, there will be a book to which one of the very best chapters is contributed by Anne Henderson called The Menzies Legacy. And there's a very elegiac essay which concludes the book and tells the story of Menzies and Canberra. In fact, it just says Menzies is the conversion of Sir Robert Menzies, and it's a wonderful chapter and very worthy of a place in a book with an excellent essay like Anne's. And this book. If you're Googling it, just it's edited by J.R. Nethercoat, so it won't be too hard for you to find.
John, many thanks. As I should say, it's many excellent chapters, including an excellent editor. And we will be discussing the Menzies legacy at the Sydney Institute in a couple of months' time when it comes out, and some of the people who wrote chapters will be here. Look, I just want to say very quickly tonight... The Australian Public Service is obviously, and has always been, a very important part of Australian society. Not a lot has been written on it in accessible format, and some people have written on it don't know a lot about it because I've never worked in it. And what we've had here tonight in John Nethercote is someone with a background across a range of aspects of the public service, including commissions looking into the public service, coming along and talking in language we can all understand about a very important part of Australian society and the history of that institution and the many of the key characters who were involved in the institution from the end of the First World War to sort of around the end of the Cold War. So it's been a great night tonight, John. I'm sure we'll have you back sometime in the future. We look forward to publishing your paper, but thank you and well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.